y'all. Welcome back to another episode of Young, Black, and Opinionated. I'm your host, Christina Royster. Make sure you hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening today. And you can follow the podcast on Instagram and Facebook at the YBO Podcast. On today's episode, I have a special guest. I speak with JP Miller. She's an award-winning author who's been published since 2013. And JP's wheelhouse is really finding those missing voices in children's literature, especially Black literature. We know that there aren't a lot of children's books out there for kids who look like me, you know, for kids who look like the typical YBO audience, young, Black, and opinionated. And so I talked to JP about how she's helping fill that gap with her literature and her writing. We talk a little bit about social identity, because we know that kids are impressionable. And right now, this episode is coming out around back to school time. And so I talked to JP about everything from her experience in, you know, 1970s segregated school until now as an author. So without further ado, let's get into it. And folks at home, as you heard in the intro, JP is an author, a scholar. And I really wanted to first ask you, what made you fall in love with Black literature?
Well, I guess, I don't want to say it was by default, but it kind of was, you know, just growing up in the 60s and 70s and, you know, North Carolina, there wasn't a lot of Black literature or anything on the shelves where the characters looked like me or the communities were reflective of mine. And then growing, you know, in adulthood, I served as the director of youth programs with Department of the Air Force for many years. And it was sort of at the beginning of the Black History Month. Well, it started off as a day, then a week, and then a month. Mm. But at any rate, it was, the early on acknowledgement of African-American history. And it was the same people being talked about over and over again, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman. You know, right. And so I just know that there's so much more to our history than the ones that keep coming up every year. So I wanted to change that a little bit. And I started writing, and my particular interest is in little known events and people in African-American history. So it's like, I'll look at it and go, hey, okay, that person's kind of known, you know, but oh my goodness, did you know about this?
Yeah.
So those are the ones that I like to bring to the forefront.
I love that because like you said, there are so many stories that are going untold, and it's not that we don't want to tell them. It's not that we aren't alive to tell them. Nobody's just giving us an opportunity sometimes. And it takes me back to, you know, the beginning of slavery and the beginning of our people coming to America. They didn't want us to read. They didn't want us to write. So I was actually learning about Frederick Douglass recently, like you said, to find out that he was like the most photographed man in the 19th century. That's crazy because still today they do want to use our image for certain things, but they don't want to give us the voice, you know?
Absolutely.
So unfortunately we kind of have to take power into our own hands at times and get our own books published just like you. So it's awesome that you've had a love of literature since you were a child until now. And like you said, filling that gap where we may not see some of our stories being told. Mm-hmm. And so right now, this is a turbulent time in our country. You know, they're trying to take these books out of schools. And I had a question for you about, you know, a child's education. What percentage do you think is up to the school and what percentage is up to the family? Because in my family, we honestly didn't talk about Black history a whole lot. It's kind of just like it was there. Like you said, like I knew I was Black and mm-hmm. and I kind of, you know, learned on my own. I was fortunate to go to a school named after Benjamin Banneker in my elementary days, where we did have a more in-depth Black History Month, where I got to dress up as Sojourner Truth, somebody that some people might not know about. But then I had a culture shock where I actually was moved to an all-white community. I went to an all-white school for middle school, high school, and we weren't saying a peep about Black history. If we did, like you said, it was Martin Luther King. So are we depending on these schools to teach our children, or does it really start at home? I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
My personal opinion is that it starts at home. I think over 50% of what our children learn, particularly about African-American history, should be from the home. Mm-hmm. And it starts with the parents being hungry to learn more. You know, I grew up not too far from the generations that actually experienced some of that some of the hardships and some of the things. My grandfather was actually a sharecropper. He was born in 1893. And then you look at where, his grandfather was. So you can pretty much assume that he was in slavery. And, tracking my family down, I have, been able to deduct when and where we were enslaved in North Carolina. But those people, I get it. They were trying to forget about the horrors of it. They didn't want to relive the horrors of it. And so I kind of get that they didn't sit down with the children and tell them what was going on, or what happened to them. But this generation, my generation, I feel like we have a responsibility to do it because it's not being told or being taught that much in the schools. And then when it is in the schools, it's being watered down, And I saw something this week that was interesting, and I'm sure I don't have all the details of it. It was on it was on Instagram that I saw it. And I think the lady was she was a parent, maybe speaking to the Virginia Senate or something like that. Anyway, it was like a group of people that she was speaking to, and she was saying how she was helping her daughter study for one of the tests. And one of the responses was that African Americans didn't know their history and they were slaves in Africa. And she was like, that's not the way it was. So how am I supposed to teach my children the right history, and then they're coming here and they're getting the wrong history? So that's the balance that we have to have also. It's like, we have to make the educators and the administrators in school responsible for teaching it as it was. And this critical race theory is not helping
I
at
was just
all.
going to ask your thoughts about that because obviously, like I just said, I grew up in the 2000s. And so I don't think I ever heard that term before, critical race theory. I think it's a new term. And I realized in my 20s, like, they're just saying that because they're embarrassed about their history. They're embarrassed that their history involves enslaving people. So, no, you don't want to talk about it. Or you might be scared to talk about how successful and accomplished Black people are because it gives us our power. So that's probably why they don't want to teach us about Black history. So,
I mean, absolutely. It's like it's still a form of oppression. And so if we can tell you that you didn't do all of these great things to make America great, it's like make America great again. No,
it
we
was
made
not
it great the
great.
first time. So it's like they don't want us to know these things. They want us to remain, and that has been the power over African Americans for the longest, is that, like you said earlier, first of all, we didn't want you to learn to read, so they knew if we learned to read that we were
That's our
very smart,
power, yeah.
and empowered. And so they didn't want us to learn to read. And so then when it came to a point, okay, you're reading, okay, well, then we have to make this narrative the way we want it. Because we still, if you learn about this or you learn about that, then that's going to give you power to stand up against us. And it's still the same way today. They don't want us to know some of this phenomenal things that African Americans have done to make America the nation that it is.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that, this is all coming up now. I guess it is, it has been a culture shift in our country, but like you said, it was kind of always there. And now I feel like we are doubling down on it just because at the same time, I am seeing, Black people in media rise up. I'm seeing the Issa Raes and the Tyler Perrys and things that we've never seen in our generation before. So it's like, yeah, you can have a little, but not too much. And so when you're talking about children, I guess it's kind of sensitive. I understand people are protective of their children, but why do you have to protect them from Black history? That doesn't make sense to me. And so are there moments where you have to be like a little more sensitive about what you say in your books or how you talk to children about certain issues? Because my partner, he actually grew up in a family that was very pro-Black, rah-rah, like his parents were teaching them about, white supremacy when they were kids. But some people think that might scare children or that might make your children standoffish and not want to make friends with other children that aren't their race. So do you think that we should be sensitive when we're talking about this to kids, or should we talk to them and tell them the real?
I mean, it's like everyone should know their children and know what they're capable of understanding. I think as a writer, I have a certain responsibility to not, you know, just be cold-hearted, you know, and come in and just say it like it, oh, people yeah. say T.I. is, you know, you just can't come in and eat. As a writer, I have to be sensitive to the fact that I'm writing to all types of families, you know, and so there's probably a certain level of sensitivity, but not watering down the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can't, I mean, it is what it is. The Tulsa massacre was a massacre, mm-hmm. you know. So you can't say that, you know, give it some, you know, flowery name or
sugar
whatever.
Coated, yeah.
Slavery was slavery. You went over, you kidnapped, you know, Black people, put them on a ship against their will and brought them to America. No, they did not come here to work. They were enslaved.
Right.
You know, so it's like things like that. No, we can't give it like that. The facts are the facts. You know,
yeah, and I like that you said, you know, it depends on the family. Some kids may already be exposed to those things, and I feel like going back to my first question, you do have to bring it up at home because you don't know what your kids are getting out there in the world.
Right.
So if you do want them to get accurate information, it's probably best to come from mom and dad.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so going back to the whole education system, I wrote a question that we can't solve all the problems. There are many problems, but if you had like a wish list of things that you would like to tackle in the American education system, I'm sure, you know, literature would be one of them, but what are some other things that are top of mind for you as you're doing this work? Because sometimes it does feel kind of hopeless at times in my generation, you know, I see us making strides, but then it's like, we take five steps back. So what is something that is on your list? Like you wish that they could just solve this today and this could all go much smoother.
Oh my. I think one of the things that I wished was a little different, it's getting better, is like the demographics of the educators.
Mm.
I think it's very important for our students to see educators like us in the classroom. I think it's important for males to see educators. So that would be one of the things to kind of have some kind of initiative to draw in BIPOC, you know, educators.
Yeah. And if I can speak on that, I personally didn't have my first Black male teacher until college, my communications professor. And so growing up, I remember we had to do one of those heritage projects in middle school at my white middle school. And I honestly didn't know how to trace my roots back. I don't think we had ancestry at that time. And some people might roll their eyes at ancestry and say that don't even do it, all it could do for Black people. But at that time, I went to my parents and I was like, where do we come from? Where are we? And like you said, the generations before didn't really pass down that information. So my mom was like, we're from Indiana. And yeah. So I chose to go with my dad's side, and my dad's side is a little biracial. My dad's like Native American and some other ethnicities. So he was like, oh, put on your report that you're Native American. I'm like, okay, Native Americans are from America. So I put that on my report. And my teacher called me out and was like, no, you're not, or something like that. Yeah. And that was so hurtful in middle school for you to deny my identity just because you don't believe that a brown skinned girl like me can have Native American.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so that was a white male teacher. And so I'm sure if I had a Black teacher, they may have understood that I don't know where my background is. I can't even do this kind of project. And so now I have traced my roots back, and I've, you know, rummaged through my grandparents' belongings, and I found out that they migrated from Arkansas to Illinois to Indiana. So even just learning that little tidbit over this summer has really helped me learn about my roots and where I'm from.
Right. And so you were saying that you didn't see your first Black male teacher until middle school.
Yes.
Okay, so I graduated high school in 78. So
okay.
You know. And I started off in all black school. And of course, I was in that whole integration thing. So
Okay.
that was all I knew. And it was in my community and they lived next to us and, you know, all of this. So that was all I had. And so when I was in seventh grade, they closed, sixth grade, going into seventh grade, they closed all the black schools down and integrated us. And so we went to these, all white schools.
And I'm sure you weren't welcome really with open arms. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Didn't really want us. And so I didn't see any black teachers again until I went to college. And I went to Tennessee State University. And so then it was like, you know, I was back to this, whoa, wait a minute, you know, kind of thing. But it's just interesting how the classrooms and educators, principals, administration, all of that is kind of was kind of, it's changed quite a bit. It's great, you know.
Yeah. But we could still make more strides because yes, on the ground level, you know, I come from a family of educators. My aunt was a principal, my mom was a teacher, and on the ground level, we have some of those people, but I've seen the nepotism in the school system, and I've seen how the superintendent will just hire their friend to be the next principal. I've seen my mom get denied for principal spots, trying to move up and trying to get a promotion. And so I think we need more diverse decision makers, like people at the top. Because they're the ones who are making those decisions. And instead of hiring another white nephew to teach this class, why don't you give this diverse teacher a chance, you know? And so that just goes back to one of your core pillars about representation. That is so important to me because people can't even dream of what's possible until they see it. I didn't think that I could be a television producer until I saw Issa Rae go from YouTube to having multiple television shows on HBO. And so that's the same in the classroom as well. Like if we're only talking about slavery and nothing else during Black History Month, and all eyes are on the Black student, it's so uncomfortable. And it just makes you want to crawl in a hole and not really stand up and be proud to be Black, not be proud of your heritage. And that goes for the media as well. I think you've talked about a little bit of representation in the media. So what are your thoughts on that? Because kids are impressionable.
Oh, yeah. And again, it's the same thing. I mean, wherever and whatever industry there is that we can, you know, pick out and speak on, the bottom line is more than likely they need to have representation. And I mean, I'm seeing a lot more of that. And I think the whole incident with George Floyd brought a lot of this to light because here was something that it's almost like he's almost like the Emmett Till, the modern day Emmett Till. So when they brought to light all of this brutality and stuff with Emmett Till and some of the changes that came from that, and now you have where a man was actually seen one moment alive and the next moment he was deceased all in front of your eyes, that made a lot of people have to be conscious of what's going on and what's going on in management and the things that writers have been saying. We need more stories and we need them in our voices, you know, and because I saw a lot after that, it was, you know, editors and agents was, oh, if you're BIPOC and you have a biography or you have a story, then send it in.
Oh, now you want to publish me.
Right. So it was a lot of people. You'll see probably in the next 2 years or so, you're going to see a lot of books like that coming out as a result of being picked up at that time frame. You know,
I remember that time frame. I got pulled into a, you know, diversity committee at the job that they kind of just slapped together or whatever. And that was one of the first things people said, like, we're doing the work, start with this reading list and looking at, you know, the same old books on that list. Right. And, and people thinking, you know, I really understand you now because I read this one book. No, it's deeper than that. It's a lot deeper than that. It's a great place to start. I'm glad that they're starting with the reading, but why do you think it is such a challenge for Black authors to tell their story? Does it kind of just go back to the industry and how, you know, you can write a book, but you got to say what we want you to say? Because I've never written a book, so could you tell us a little bit about that process?
Yeah, and again, like you said, it's getting people at the top that can make those decisions. It's getting senior editors in place that are Black and brown. It's getting, you know, publishers, more publishers that are Black and brown. And so it's just starting at the top. You can have all of these writers that you want at the bottom, but when you send it to an editor for it to be, you know, revised or whatever, and you send it to this person, you know, all the people within the publishing industry or publishing house that you're going through, there's so many other eyes that's looking at it. In fact, I heard Jason Reynolds, I think it was, I was listening to him in a conversation that he was having, and he said that most of the time when we write a story, we may write the story and it get accepted by a publishing house or sold to a publishing house, but by the time it comes out, so many people have had input in it that is, it almost becomes our story.
Yeah.
But if we don't have those people that have that type of power and input for our story, it can change it drastically. And I have a situation like that that just happened with me. And fortunately, you know, we came to an agreement that, you know, we'll just move on. But at any rate, the story had changed so drastically from the one that they accepted, you know, and I won't go into any details, but it was one of those situations. So, yeah. If you have enough people around the table that understands that, you know, this is something that this Black culture. So no, you can't take that piece out. You know,
right.
If a Black person reads this, they know what a kitchen is, and we ain't talking about to go in to cook. You know what I mean? So just leave it like that. The kitchen is the kitchen. You know.
Yeah, and I like that you point that out, because that goes back to what you said about watering it down. Like, I understand that we are kind of the gatekeepers of our culture, and you know, we are. I enjoy sharing Black culture with people, because I remember in college, I had an international student in my dorm from England, and she was like, "Why do you wrap your hair up like that at night?" I took the opportunity to tell her, instead of telling her like, "Oh, you wouldn't get it," or whatever, you know, get it aggravated. I think it is important to take the time to educate folks, because how do we expect them to learn unless somebody tells them?
Yeah.
And I would rather you ask me than go Google it and think you know everything from Instagram. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, I think that it's just hard though to, like, as an artist, to have your work be like changed so much. So, like, how do you, without getting into detail, like, how do you stand your ground and like push back a little bit?
You just, like, I think it was Kenny Rogers' song, "You got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them."
Pick your battles.
in the whole scheme of things, you just have to know, like, basically what to fight for and what not to fight for. And how you can make a revision and say the same thing that has the same strength without any pushback. So, and if you've gotten your manuscript back from your editor, you know, you go through it and you just look and say, okay, now what is it that I'm really going to fight for to remain the same? Or is this, I can change that, you know? So you just don't want to be, you know, just like hardcore.
Hard to work with. Yeah.
It's going to stay like this and I don't want any changes, because you're not going to make it.
Yeah.
But yeah, you just have to know when to hold them, know when to fold them.
That's really good advice. And so I know you have a series coming out soon, or you're part of a series actually for grades 5 through 9, and your book's going to be all about HBCU. So can you talk a little bit about the inspiration behind that? Because I went to a PWI, and now that I'm older, I'm like, dang, I wish I went to HBCU, because there's so much culture. But again, that was something that we really didn't talk about in my family. My parents didn't go to HBCUs. My parents almost didn't get to go to college. So I feel like students still don't know their options, and it would be great to learn more about HBCUs. So where did that inspiration come from?
Ooh, honey, I am so in love with this book.
Yay.
So in love. It's like the best thing since sliced bread. So this is called, it's called Travel to HBCUs. And it's part of a Travel to series by Carson DeLosa with Rourke Education. And I think there's one that's Travel
I saw to... one that was like landmarks, and then the other one was like protest destinations.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting, because again, that's a subject where I'm like, oh, we're talking to fifth graders about protesting? Like, I didn't know we're talking about that. So
Right. So I was so excited And actually, the editor came to me several years ago and asked, is there anything else that you'd like to write about? And so I wrote for them the Leaders Like Us series, and that's kind of like ongoing, a cumulative kind of series. And so I wrote that for them, and I wrote Careers in the U.S. Military. I'm prior Air Force, and so they were like, "Is there anything else you'd like to write about?" And I said, "Yes, I would like to write about HBCUs." And one of the things that I noticed, I took my god grand to register for middle school, and so there was all of these banners up. I'm in the state of Georgia, and there was, the University of Georgia, and it was Georgia Tech, and it was Georgia State, and it was, and I was like, okay, so where are the HBCUs that are in Georgia?
Right.
So these students are going to counselors, but they're not seeing the representation of HBCUs. They're not being offered HBCUs. And I know when I was growing up, I'm kind of in that betwixt and between. So, being I went in college in 78. Yeah, I went in college in 78. And so, a lot of like my parents and people of that age group, of course, HBCUs were a place to go. If you was going to go to college, that's where you were going to go. So
The
they were
PWIs
still
may not
kind of
have, were they
pushing.
taking us at that time? PWIs?
Right. So they barely. And so the majority of us were being pushed towards HBCUs. Even in high school, they really didn't let us go. If I grew up in North Carolina, so if North Carolina, Chapel Hill or Duke or those were coming for a college day, they would kind of steer us to the HBCUs. They didn't, not to those. So then we started getting into this era where we were being told, oh, don't go over there to HBCU. You don't, the education ain't this, and it's,
That's what I heard in my generation. People said like, oh, it's not the teachers are bad. It's not the same education.
right. Yeah. And so everybody started kind of migrating away from HBCUs. And so I just wanted to bring that power back. Man, it's nothing like it. I went to Tennessee State University. Go Big Blue. Give a shout out. But man, it was great. I loved going to HBCU. Nothing like the culture, nothing like seeing the Greeks on the yard, nothing like the band, a pep rally. I mean, the classes, the teachers, it was like amazing. And it was amazing what they did to make sure that you succeeded. Whereas if you went, now I don't know, I can't say for sure because I didn't go to a PWI. But I've heard and talked to people who, when that went to a PWI, they didn't get that same treatment
I had the
or
Black
just,
Student Union. That was about it.
yeah. So I just wanted to bring that all back to light. Attention is going back to our HBCUs. I am so proud of that. And one of the things that I couldn't talk about all of them. So, we have over 100. And so I kind of went through and looked at the top 20, 25, and tried to incorporate them into the book as best I could. So I have it broken down into categories like HBCUs that influenced the civil rights movement, HBCUs with the best academics, HBCUs with the best sports, culture, and then I have a category with the best, basically most interesting trivia. And so I was having a blast doing that book. And I can't wait for it to come out. I think it's in the fall. I haven't gotten the official date yet, but I can't wait to go out and, go to homecomings, and hopefully sororities and fraternities will buy the books and give it to children for gifts or their local library or school guidance counselor or something. I feel like it's going to be pretty big.
It sounds like it. And honestly, as you're describing it, I don't have children of my own yet, but I feel like that's just the kind of book that I would love to have in my kids' room. Like, imagine influencing somebody already in the fifth grade and they already decide, like, I want to go to HBCU one day, you know, that's exactly where it starts. And some people I know, like, they kind of grew up like that, like, oh, my parents went to Harvard, so I'm going to Harvard, or Howard, sorry. Going to Howard. And I didn't have that kind of relationship. So I bet if I saw a book like that, then that would really inspire me. So,
yeah. And the fact that you can Google, you can walk in any bookstore, you can walk in any library. And right now, there is no such book on HBCUs.
Wow.
I've seen a couple of books that were self-published that may have been on Howard or, you know, something. I can't remember. I remember Howard specifically. There was a children's book that someone self-published on that. But in terms of like Rourke Educational is one of the top five in educational market. And the fact that it's coming from, you know, being published through them and it's going out to, it'll be school libraries, school library journal will probably be one of the first to see it and maybe even give a review on it. Ooh, so awesome. I'm excited about seeing what they say. And just the you know, I start off with the history of them. I talk about, you know, and then inside I have so many sidebars and about, you know, some of those stereotypes that we've heard that, you know, oh, you won't, you know, the teachers aren't diverse there. So I break it down. How many, you know, teachers are African-American? How many are other ethnicities? And just, you know, the fact that it's like, well, with each one, I also state someone of celebrity status, male and female, that went to that school. And so all of these people, guidance counselors and educators that would say, oh, don't go over there, it's substandard and da-da-da-da. So if we can have a vice president of the United States graduate from HBCU, if we can have Oprah Winfrey, the richest woman in, you
she's
know,
a billionaire status.
Yeah. Graduate from an HBCU. You can't tell me that you can't go to an HBCU and thrive. So that's, you know, that's,
I'm so excited for you. Yes. And you're just inspiring me because ever since I was a kid, I'd said that I wanted to be an author. I used to like illustrate my own children's books because I'm also an artist. And so it's still on my bucket list. I definitely want to do that one day. And you're just making me realize like the time is now. There's the internet. We can get started nowadays. We don't have to wait for somebody to give us a book deal to get our story out there.
Right.
And so my last question for you is, what is the best advice that you've learned or received on this journey that you would like to share with the next generation of change makers like me?
You know what? I just say, do it. Let your faith carry you. So, and the reason that I had to add that last little bit is because when I was growing up, you know, there are so many things like almost like each part of my life, there was something else, you know. Initially I wanted to be this great basketball, you know, star, and, you know, maybe at that time they didn't have the WNBA, but you know, I wanted to go pro or play at some level that hadn't even been established yet. But, you know, I played basketball and I would go out and practice or, you know, play pickup games basically. And then I went through a phase of, with track. You know, and, you know, I was going to, you know, I was going to go to the Olympics and I was going to be like Wilma Rudolph and some of the other Greeks and come home with the gold. And that didn't happen. Went to, you know, college, graduate. I did well, Dean's List, all this kind of stuff, go out into my career. And I was trying to get to a certain level in my career, you know, six figures, like, you know, everybody else was probably trying to. And I didn't reach that either. But I say all of that to say that if I had the faith that I have now, then I would have gotten in. If I wanted to be a basketball player, then I would have gotten in and started studying more. Of course, now the internet, you have more things at your fingertips. So use what you have. You know, we didn't have all of that then, but I could have gotten books, you know, to teach me form, to teach me this, to teach me that, you know. Parents couldn't necessarily afford to have a coach for me, but I could have been hungry enough to go out and learn it for myself. So that's the thing that I would say. And just because you have this goal and you don't succeed at it, that's not reason to quit.
Yes.
Because I use each one of those things. So I wanted to, I wanted to play basketball and be this big basketball star. That didn't happen, but I could step off of that to work on, okay, so now I want to run track and I do my best in track. I didn't make that, but I use it as a step to elevate me to the next level. So everything that I did and didn't succeed, I basically use it as my superpower, not as something to sit back and say, woe is me, everything I tried.
Every single experience you had was a stepping stone for your career, and just having that faith and having that confidence. And I love what you said about not beating yourself up, because it is hard as a creator, as a creative, or if you're a writer, an artist, a musician, whatever, to not see your setbacks as a failure, but really take it as a lesson. So mm-hmm. It sounds like you've really done the same in your career as well. And so as far as, inspiring the next great writers and what kind of stories need to be told, what have you been hearing in your industry? What's trending right now, and where should we focus? What kind of stories are we still missing?
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing right now in the industry, it all depends from the education standpoint. Our educational publishing, they're still looking at a lot of biographies. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much, if you're trying to go through traditional publishing, the majority of them are looking for more Black joy. Like you said earlier, we're beyond the stage of slavery, although there's still new things that we're learning about that stage of our entry into this country. But for the most part, it's like, where are we now? Yes. How are we experiencing life now in America? And so those are the things, Black culture, Black joy, Black spirituality, all of that is kind of what's, being looked at now and being sought after now in the industry.
I love that, because I think there is also a culture change or shift within our own culture, and it's like whatever's going on within our culture, that's kind of how we see it on TV like 5-10 years later. And so mm-hmm. I'm thinking about like the natural hair journey and how at first, like you said, 60s, 70s, people were starting to rock their afros. Then we saw people starting to go back to the straight hair. And now with my generation, I didn't embrace my natural hair until 2013. And so mm-hmm. now I see this, new children's book. I think the one by Matthew Cherry about the Black dad doing his daughter's hair, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. stories like that we never saw before. And that just goes to show how we're changing the culture within ourselves, and then we're also changing how we're represented out there. So
right.
I love
and even,
that.
Even stories, in fiction, generally fiction, you saw, white characters with, white settings and all of that. And so now, in fiction and graphic novels and sci-fi, you're seeing young adult and middle grade and early chapter books about young, Black heroes and sheroes, and fantasy type, writing. And so all of that is great, because growing up, I didn't, maybe you didn't, have those type of characters in books to read about, so you're seeing a lot more of that too. And that's wonderful that we can see ourselves in each of the genres of literature.
Yeah. I'm smiling because I am like a Marvel fan, and just to see even the explosion of Spider-Verse and Miles Morales, and now we have a Afro-Latino Spider-Man, those are things that I never thought would be possible. Or even Black Panther, now we have kids who get to dress up as a Black Panther,
right.
or just 10 years ago, we didn't have that representation. So it all starts with us, the creators and the writers who have these ideas. We need to
Absolutely.
Get them out there, because otherwise we're not going to know it exists,
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, JP, for sharing your story and encouraging my listeners to also share theirs, because I think that a lot of my audience is creators and people who are sitting on these ideas, but are kind of just too afraid to take a chance. I know I have a friend who's been sitting on a Black anime podcast idea. And if you're listening to this, I'm talking to you. He's been sitting on this idea, and I'm like, that's never been done before. At least I haven't seen it been done before.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I think sometimes we're looking for a blueprint. We're looking for, okay, how did this person do it? But it might not be done yet. We might be the ones to create that blueprint.
Yeah. And I think part of it is fear. I think, you know, we have these ideas, like it says, you know, the cemetery has more ideas than, you know, like, because people took an idea to their grave, you know, but it's like we have these fears that if we tell somebody that they're going to take our story or whatever, you know, and maybe that will happen. You know, I've never had it happen to me, but maybe it could happen. But we just have to take safety measures to protect our thoughts and our ideas and go for them, because otherwise it's going to be something that we take to our grave as well. You know, there's recipe, yeah, there's books, there's music that people have taken to their grave because fear of whatever level. And I find most people, when someone come to me and say, oh, I'd like to write a book or whatever. And a lot of times they won't even tell me what their idea is. And that, I mean, and that's fine. If you, you know, if you feel that way, then, you know, that's fine, but you can't hold on to it forever. You've got to get it out there. Okay. If you have this idea and you're afraid that you don't want somebody to get it, then go ahead and get a copyright on it. Mm-hmm. You know, just go to the government page for Office of Patent and Copyrights and file it. And then you can tell people about it, or do the poor person's, you know, copyright and put your idea in, register it, send it to yourself, and it's there. Somebody else take it. Then you can take that to court and say, that was my idea. This is the seal being broken. Da 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 da. You know, but just don't operate out of fear or, you know, being afraid to take that first step. Find critique. If you're a writer, find a critique group. Or if you, you know, if you write movie scripts, then find like people. And just about, you know, everybody's trying to make it, you know.
Yes.
So they got their thing, they have their story, they trying to make that. But if they can help you improve yours, then a lot of people are willing to do that, because they're trying to, you know, to come up. It's not this crab mentality. Not always. I'm not going to say it's not out there, but, you know, it's not like this crab mentality to try to pull you down so that they can come up. There's a lot of helpful people out there. In fact, and I don't know how much time we have left, but Gwendolyn Hooks, who is NAACP Image Award writer, is the one that gave my name to the first two editors for me to be considered to write a couple of these series, Leaders Wow. Like Us being one of them. So here's this person that could very well have said, yeah, I'll take that project, but I won't be able to do it until such and such date. But she says, no, I know of an aspiring writer that's really good. Can I recommend you to them? I was like, sure. So they wanted a sample. I gave them my sample, and the rest is history. But I call her my literary mother because of what she did for me. She didn't have to do that.
Right.
And there's so many other people that are like that out there in the community that is willing to help someone that's trying to get started. But you can't, you know, there's a difference between wanting someone to help you and give you guidance or give you recommendations or whatever. It's not like that, you know, it's not like that old street hustle and, you know, hookup thing. You gotta go in and you gotta prove yourself.
Right.
So you're just not gonna walk up to somebody and you just wrote, because really when I look at like the very first very first book that I wrote back in the day, back in the late 1990s, that story that I wrote then, thinking that I was ready to self-publish and I was going to be on Oprah and I was going to do all this stuff, I look at that stuff now and laugh at it, you know. So, yeah, but it's just the growth, going to workshops, being a part of the Authors Guild, be a part of the Society of Children's Books and Writers and Illustrators, you know, find professional organizations. They have workshops. And you improve your writing skills or whatever from there. So that's my
I story. Love that. I really love that you added that, because I think sometimes we are working in a bubble. Like I said, I have a million ideas, but I'm just sitting on them. And sometimes I am just scared to reach out to people. And that's where it could start. You know, hey, could you take a look at my script? Or could you just let me know your thoughts on this? That could go a long way. And I also, I have been learning to embrace feedback. I have been learning that feedback is a gift. It's not anybody coming for me or my ideas. It is just all to help me be, like you said, become a better writer and to grow. And I love what you said about people speaking your names in rooms that you might not even be in. Like if you just network and make those connections, it may not be instantaneous. I think my generation does want to like, let me be famous now. I want to be on Oprah's Book Plus now. But if you're building those connections with people, you don't know, in a couple of years, somebody might think, hey, I remember this girl, Christina, let me introduce you to her.
Yeah.
And so I think that really is a great point to leave off of, you know, that we can't do it all on our own, that it does take our community. And at the end of the day, of course, your name's going to be on the book, but there were a lot of people who helped you get there. So never forget where you came from and who helped you out.
Yes.
All right, y'all, that's a wrap on another episode of YBO. Make sure you hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening today. Leave me a rate, leave me a review if you like what you heard. And definitely check out author JP Miller at authorjpmiller2020.com. Check out her bio, learn more about her, and hopefully we can all purchase one of her books this fall for a child in our lives. You know, we need more kids reading, and we also need more kids reading books where they see themselves. Make sure you follow the podcast on Instagram and Facebook at the YBO Podcast, and you can follow me, Miss Chris D, MISSCHRISDEE, on all social platforms. See you soon. Bye.